This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 4th of May 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. This week we're asking, how do you reboot a classic? Great works and well-loved products are always being rewritten, redesigned, remixed, or remastered. In the past couple of weeks, it's been announced that a remake of cult horror movie classic Don't Look Now is going into production. John Lennon's solo albums are set to be repackaged as a box set, and Absolute Vodka have redesigned their well-known bottle. But how do you do this successfully? How subtle or how brash should you be about reworking something the public are so au fait with? We're posing the question, how do you reboot a classic, to a few experts, including theatre critic Matt Wolfe, Far From the Madding Crowd screenwriter David Nichols and director Thomas Vinterberg, and design prof and guru, why not, Lawrence Zeegan.
You're constantly, as a designer, thinking about your audience, and that audience for publishers constantly has to shift. You know, you've got to reintroduce classics to new audiences.
That's all to come right here on this classic edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. The question we're asking this week is, how do you reboot a classic? And I'm very lucky to be joined across the desk here in Studio 2 by Lawrence Zeegan from the London College of Communication. I feel that we've exactly zeroed in on your and one of your areas of expertise, Lawrence. Welcome to the programme, first of all.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
We talked, didn't we? We talked about book designs, books that sort of come out of their 50-year copyright rule and get rebooted and repackaged, get contemporized. We talked about everything from sort of Shakespeare play posters. There's all sorts of stuff. And of course, good old product packaging as well. Where on earth are you going to start us off?
I think I probably have to start with, well, maybe the earliest book, right. The Bible. Let me preface that. I'm not a deeply religious person, but I am very aware that the Bible will have been through many redesigns. What was really interesting, in the late 1990s, Canongate really rebooted. Angus Highland was an independent designer. He's now a partner at Pentagram. I think one of the reasons he moved to Pentagram was the strength of this project, redesigning the New Testament as a set of books for Canongate. And they were really revolutionary at the time, and I think led a lot of people to kind of rediscover the Bible. It's gone through a reboot even more recently. Crush Design down in Brighton have done the same thing. A very interesting reboot, a very interesting cover, a kind of an image of Adam and Eve in the garden, very iconic, almost a 12-inch record sleeve.
It kind of almost is, actually, looking at that across the table there, Lawrence. It's kind of something that it might almost be kind of like a David Nichols book cover. It's kind of almost like a love story. Maybe it's a doomed one.
I think, you know, even with a title like The Bible, every now and again, it's going to need to have a cover that screams at you as you walk across a Terminal 5.
It's an interesting one as well. You're talking about the Canongate repackaging of the New Testament. It seems that that was almost trying to sell it also as separate books, giving it that sense of kind of an order and almost the idea of a collection that you would want to buy one and collect the set, a bit like a collection of thrillers or adventure stories.
You know? Absolutely. And I think, you know, there are creative, inventive ways of repackaging iconic classics, and that worked very well. I'd say another great example, and if you look back at the kind of history of book covers for Lolita, for example, you know, great creativity explored through those covers. And I think it's a title that, you know, there's always going to be a slight angst in terms of how you depict that story. It's not a PC story, let's be honest about it. And I think that over time, there have been some really kind of classic rethinks of how new generations come to older stories.
And I suppose that's the strength. I suppose the things that get rebooted, repackaged, contemporized for the audience of today are things that have stood the time as works of art, whether they're, well, we're talking about novels at the moment. I suppose that the set text has to be of the quality that lingers on the bookshelf, that lingers in the memory, the collective memory of people, in order for it to be worth doing. Something like Lolita presumably must be balm to the designer's vanity, right? Because there are so many themes. You can go naughty, you can go straight, you can... There are a lot of different themes to riff on, I guess.
Absolutely. But I think this, if you like, the kind of moment for the designer is, well, how do you take this in a new direction? Where do you start from, given that there's already that very rich visual history? Where do you take a new visual stance? And, you know, some designers waver under that kind of pressure. You're constantly, as a designer, thinking about your audience, and that audience for publishers constantly has to shift. You know, you've got to reintroduce classics to new audiences. I think Moby Dick is another fine example. You know, here is a magnificent story that's had to be retold through the visual iconography of the cover because the text itself can't be retold.
I wonder why this doesn't happen in the field of LPs, of albums, that I suppose the cover art was so iconic, in never mind the Bollocks, the 1977 record by the Sex Pistols, such an iconic cover. Why has no one messed around with that, but they're prepared to mess with the cover of Lolita?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think there is a substantial difference to those that rebuy records that they had in their youth or are introduced to them for the first time 20, 25 years after they were released. Also, what record companies are able to do in a way that publishers can't is that they can repackage the contents in different ways. So, you know, Never Mind the Bollocks has been released in numerous different ways, of course, numerous different formats, CD, etc. And they can add some additional tracks. They can do a 25th anniversary issue with a few more tracks. I mean, actually, Never Mind the Bollocks, first released in fluoro yellow. Later, the American import came in as a kind of fluoro green. It always held true to Jamie Reed's original design to some extent. And I think there is something about being transported back to a point when that record was released. You don't meddle with those kind of classics. And I think it's kind of unfortunate that book jacket design doesn't have that kind of same, you know, status.
It hasn't got that iconographic kind of status, maybe, where people remember buying that with their pocket money when they were 17 or whatever, yeah. Their first paycheck, you know, a little bit older. We promised we weren't just going to be talking about books, though, Lawrence. Product design, I mean, obviously, in your role at the London College of Communications, you cover all of this stuff, and presumably you treat all these imposters just the same, whether they're a Coke bottle, whether they are the cover of Lolita, the first edition, whatever. Let's move it on and talk about some of the things that maybe we find in our kitchen cupboards or behind the bar rather than on our bookshelves.
Well, you mentioned Coca-Cola. It's 100 years old this year. The bottle, the classic, the shape. Weirdly, and I'm not sure if you knew this, but I've collected Coca-Cola bottles since about the age of, well, since I started interrailing as a student many, many, many years ago. So my rule is I bring a Coke bottle back from anywhere around the world and it comes into my collection. I don't know, 500-600 Coca-Cola bottles, all actually quite different. But the interesting story for Coke was that they meddled with the formula. They meddled with the formula during the 80s. There was such an issue with customer drop-off and complaints that they had to then reboot and call the original Coke Classic. And the packaging had to reflect that as well.
And the Coke bottle, people will maybe need a silhouette of a timeline of how this bottle has changed from, well, I guess the 1890s. Mm. Right up until today. What are the design touches? How much, for example, have Coca-Cola messed with that original design of the bottle? Maybe less so than the interior of it.
Yeah, messed maybe not. Finessed, but possibly, if I'm kind. Amongst my collection, they've produced commemorative bottles for particular kind of, you know, baseball World Series, etc. And you can't, and the Olympics, you can understand why that happens. Where they've started to finesse, you know, the introduction of aluminium Coke bottles some years ago, 10 years ago or so, where they have messed, they've been very quick to turn that around and re-establish that, you know, the contour bottle. We all think we know that bottle, but when you look at, you know, 100 of them, there are huge variations in terms of the detail of the shape, the weight of the glass, the colour of the bottle. So it's iconic, but that iconic shape shifts.
And just generally, I mean, we can encompass all of the things we've talked about, novels, records, making anniversaries for sort of classic albums, and product design as well. Are there tricks to updating a classic, to sort of rebooting a classic, that people tend to do? Can we see square corners getting rounder? Can we see uppercase going lowercase and becoming more like a URL, you know, a website address? Are there things that you can see during your career and studying it and teaching this stuff, Lawrence, that you can see are leitmotifs of what we will call, with a small p, not a big one, progress?
Yeah, good question. And just the notion of rebooting, you know, rebooting, kind of restarting, or you shut the thing down and it's a complete brand new start.
Control-Alt-Delete.
Exactly.
Or just throw it out the window and buy a new one. Yeah.
There was the Museum of Packaging and Branding in West London, fantastic place to go if you want to see the subtle nuances in terms of the kind of developmental changes that happen to a product. I remember visiting there a couple of years ago and seeing a display of milk tray boxes. And they showed milk tray boxes over about a 15, 20-year period. And actually, from the start to the finish, huge changes. But incrementally, annually, those changes were so subtle that the customers didn't see them happening. But they were kind of refreshing. They were modernizing. There were tweaks to the typography, the silhouette of the man all in black that would deliver this in the 1970s ad. He was kind of made more Bond-esque at one point. So I think the true challenges are in updating, refreshing, without necessarily your audience, your customers seeing bold shifts, bold moves, because people like to work with a brand. They like to enjoy a brand. They like to take that brand, bring that brand into their own homes. And if that brand, as they're shopping for it, shifts more than incrementally, they want to know why. Their first impression will be suspicious. They'll assume that the price has gone up or the weight has gone down. And the kind of companies that have made dramatic shifts, I'm old enough to remember when Crisps decided that green and blue would revert from salt and vinegar and cheese and onion. You know, they were the other way around decades ago.
I still don't know what I'm doing in the crisps aisle of the supermarket. I'm still lost.
Yeah, so those kind of changes make no sense to the consumer, and we don't forget them. We want that brand affiliation.
That was Professor Lawrence Zeegan, Dean of the School of Design at the London College of Communication. Up next, the Madding Crowd. We're moving swiftly on to film now, with a classic that's been rebooted into cinemas this month. Thomas Hardy's acclaimed 1874 novel Far From the Madding Crowd was famously adapted for the screen in 1967 for Alan Bates and Julie Christie. The story of headstrong Bathsheba Everdeen and her three suitors has now been remade, this time directed by Thomas Vinterberg and screenwritten by David Nichols. Monocle's Megan Billing sat down with the team behind the film to chat about their perspectives on reinventing the classic story.
From now on, you have a mistress, not a master. I don't yet know my talents in farming, but I shall do my best. Don't suppose because I'm a woman I don't know the difference between bad goings on and good. I shall be up before you are awake. I shall be afield before you are up. It is my intention to astonish you all. Back to work, please.
I've loved Hardy since I was a teenager. Hardy and Dickens, you know, they were the first kind of proper classics that I read and loved. And I found them very moving and very exciting and beautifully written. The novel is very episodic. I mean, Hardy writes in sort of set pieces. That's not to say it doesn't have a plot, but he's not afraid to stop and go off on a tangent and maybe explore the life of, say, the workers on the farm or explore the backstory of the characters. And that stuff is the first stuff to go. The ending of the novel is wonderful, but it's very melodramatic. It's kind of crazy. There's a whole sequence where Troy comes back in disguise and Bathsheba sees him perform in a circus and doesn't know it's him, and he sees it in the audience, and it's sort of crazy, but a very hard thing to do in the more realistic medium of films. So we pulled back on some of the melodrama. We wanted it to be a kind of close-up movie, I suppose. We wanted to focus in on the five main characters and have a series of very dramatic, almost two-hander scenes between them. So that was the area we focused in on.
I like the idea very much that you are an author as well as a screenwriter, and that you actually wrote one day and then adapted it to the screen. So you've been through this with your own work, and I wonder if that makes you different than maybe another screenwriter who's adapting a book.
Adapting your own work is a unique experience and uniquely frustrating, because you've lived with this thing for 3 years and you've played it in your head and you know everything about it. You know what the characters look like and what they're wearing and what music's playing in the background. You're basically doing everything in the form of a novel. And then when you become the screenwriter, you have to hand over that responsibility to a whole load of other people. And that's great, because often, you know, they surprise you and they envision it in an entirely different way. But also really frustrating, because your power is suddenly, you know, horribly diminished. You know, with a novel, it's just me. There's no one else. I mean, I have a very good editor, but the text is basically all mine. And with a movie, it's you're part of a team of 100, and you have to be prepared to abdicate some responsibility. Adapting someone else's work, I suppose I think of myself more as an editor. I suppose there's a kind of technical quality to the work because a lot of it is about distilling and reducing. A lot of it is about how you get the character's internal life, their emotions, their thoughts and emotions onto the screen. Because a novel is, even if it's written in the third person, a novel is a first person form. It's about feelings and emotions as well as action and dialogue. With a screenplay, it really is about what people say and do. And that's the toughest thing to get around. That's the hardest leap to make.
I actually wanted to bring that up because I was thinking about being a screenwriter, and particularly for a period piece, there are so many longing looks.
Yeah.
And it's very angsty. I felt a lot of angst when I was watching this film. And that isn't necessarily something you can script it, but at the end of the day, it depends what the director does and the actors do.
Absolutely. The pacing of a scene. I mean, a lot of the scenes you see in the movie are very seamlessly edited, but they're half the length of what they were on set. You know, there's a lot of dialogue taken out because, again, when you suddenly realize when you watch it with great actors performing that you don't need all those words. And that's the hardest thing for me as a novelist. You know, I want there to be words on the page. I want it to be longer. You can never tell on the page. That's the thing I find kind of endlessly fascinating and frustrating about screenwriting. You just can't tell on the page what an actor will bring and what the environment will bring and what a costume will suggest that you no longer have to express in words. There's always an element of experimentation, I suppose. Exploration is a better word when you transpose a script to the screen.
Perhaps you'd care to lend a hand?
You don't think I would?
No, you wouldn't. Come here.
I guess one of the points in asking a Dane to do this huge British novel was to get rid of that sense of the weight of the cultural heritage. Thomas Hardy is not on our curriculum. I hadn't seen the Schlesinger movie at that time. I haven't either now. I wanted to pretend that this was a one-off love affair between Thomas Hardy and Thomas Vinterberg. So I came into this with a pure and clean love to these characters whom I had met for the first time.
I get the sense that you didn't come into this worrying if you were going to insult anyone by leaving something out or not being true to what they imagined from the book or from the original film.
Well, that is two different questions, because one thing is how to deal with an adaptation. The main challenge of this whole project lies embedded in doing an adaptation where you have to make decisions about what's in and what's out. And we had to leave an awful lot out. And that was a very painful process and difficult. And a process that was going on all the way through making this film. In the script, we worked a lot on it. We went out shooting far too much material. We ended up with a four-hour movie, having to cut that down. And, you know, that is the main challenge of this adaptation. But I cannot adapt anyone else's vision of a character. I can envision something when I read it. And together with some actors and through a casting process, we can try to bring something to life. And there's no way you can copy that from anyone. But what you can do is you can try to stay loyal to the Hardy universe. I was humbled by his book. So we were constantly exploring that book and exploring the inner life of those characters in that book. Hopefully that is to be seen on screen.
Miss Bathsheba Everdeen, I brought you a lamb.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Oak. He's such a dear thing.
He's come too soon and won't last the winter, so I thought you'd like to rear it instead.
Thank you, that's very kind.
The lamb is not why I came.
Go on.
Well, Miss Everdeen, I wanted to ask, would you like to marry me?
That was the director and screenwriter of that new Far From the Madding Crowd, Thomas Vinterberg and David Nichols, speaking to Megan Billings in New York City. While classic films are often being remade, often much to the horror of their fans, stage productions are rehashed over and over and over again. But how do you keep an audience interested enough to keep coming back? And how do you interpret a script and cast the lead in order to do the text justice? We invited Monocle regular and theatre critic for the International New York Times, Matt Wolfe, to answer the question, how do you reboot a classic play?
Well, it's a question critics ask themselves all the time when they go to see a classic. And this happens, I would say, probably more in London than New York, because one of the things about the London theatre is that it looks back as well as ahead. And sometimes it does both at the same time, in that by looking back, it forces a reappreciation that makes you see the thing anew as if you're looking ahead. It's that old adage that the World Court Theatre used to coin for itself, but it applies across, I think, all the arts, which is that you want to take the time-honored thing and make it seem new, and you want the new thing to seem canonical. So the classic seems modern, the modern seems classic. What I think you essentially are looking for, in theatrical terms anyway, are several things. One is freshness, something about it that however many times you've seen Hamlet before, this Hamlet is going to force a reassessment, like, you know, hearing Yasha Heifetz play the Beethoven violin concerto might be different from hearing Anne-Sophie Mutter do it. Or passion is very important. Is there a reason for this to be happening rather than just another trawl through Twelfth Night? And when you see the classics on as regular a basis as you do in London, you see plenty of examples that fall into both categories, where on the one hand, the thing is entirely, although the title is familiar, it seems like in a way you've never seen it that way before, or you just think, why are we sitting here?
That's a fascinating point. What a great starting point as well. I like your analogy of two virtuosi fighting over or reinterpreting a very well-known piece of classical music. Can you see the cogs sometimes moving to make certain plays, certain interpretations of the canon? Can you see the cogs working to be different from the one that went before, often on the stage?
Yeah, I mean, I think if one wants to talk in terms of venue, the theatre in the UK that leads the pack with all of this is the Young Vic near Waterloo. Small but important, disproportionate to its size. And they've sort of established themselves as the leading theatre, I would say, probably in the English-speaking world, for taking these canonical plays and tilting them on their axes. So, for instance, last summer there was a much ballyhooed production of Tennessee Williams' A Streetcar Named Desire with Gillian Anderson and Ben Foster, where it was a non-literal set. It looked like it was taking place in a sort of IKEA bathroom sort of showpiece. And the set kept revolving. And everything about it physically was different. As a result, everything about it emotionally was different, because it was like you were looking at sort of rats in a cage. Sometimes with these sorts of things, the result might be to achieve X, and in fact, X isn't achieved, and all you're aware of is the shortfall between what the director wanted and what you're actually getting.
It's one of those things, I suppose, also talking about when people are so familiar with the staging of certain sorts of plays, whether it is a French farce, or whether it is a sort of genre, or whether it is, as you say, staging something like a Beckett play, something that is stripped back, something that is all about the language, something that is all about sort of almost restricting the actors. It is difficult to think of Noel Coward's Private Lives being done in a sort of gritty urban setting, because the whole point of it is that it isn't that.
Yes.
But nonetheless, these things are plays that are rebooted and almost fight against the verse or the prose that they're written in. When they sort of reach above those and fit into their new surroundings, does that add an extra weight to the words that the actors are delivering that really makes you think about the text?
Well, that's a really smart question. I mean, a lot of it is about subverting visual expectation. And again, sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. I mean, there was a production last summer on the West End of Richard III with Martin Freeman, and it was set in a kind of apparatchik's office in some sort of peculiar unnamed contemporary state. You know, is it Stalinist? Not quite, but it certainly wasn't what you might think of, you know, sort of contemporary Shakespeare militarism. And the result was that it was very visually sort of askew, and a lot of people couldn't find the play for the visuals that were attached to the play.
Well, we're getting on to cast, we're getting on to starring roles. We should address this. You mentioned Martin Freeman and Richard III. Listeners, instead of Googling Martin Freeman, of course, a lot of people will be familiar with him. He started off as Tim in the UK Office. He plays Bilbo Baggins. I mean, he's done a lot of different things very brilliantly. He doesn't strike me as being a Richard III. My question was going to be, and we can incorporate Martin Freeman into the answer perhaps, about whether putting an actor or an actress in a role that people might think jars with their expectations of the role is a very easy way of rebooting a classic.
Well, certainly there's always a strange synergy or disconnect, depending on how it lands. A lot of it is about landing, whereby you think, has the actor been cast as just sort of a stunt? And who drove the casting? Mm. Was it something that came out of, you know, an agent's lunch by the pool in Beverly Hills, and some hapless actor or actress as a result of it has been, you know, dropped into something for which they're ridiculously ill-suited? Or maybe it's not that at all. Maybe the actor has always said, you know, I've always wanted to do a kind of relatively modern Richard III set in a faceless European state. And you don't really know where it's coming from. In America, I'm sorry to say, because Broadway is so enthralled to the star thing, you often feel sometimes that they've been willfully cast against type in a way that doesn't really help them. I mean, one thinks John C. Reilly, wonderful film actor, Oscar nominated for the movie Chicago, really fine, fine actor, who, speaking of A Streetcar Named Desire, some years ago played Stanley Kowalski opposite the Blanche DuBois of Natasha Richardson. And he just isn't temperamentally, physically, emotionally a Stanley Kowalski. So that was kind of one stretch too far. So I think a lot of it is, does the actor, him or herself, suit the role? Are they willing to accommodate what could be a disconnect, and what do they bring to it that is sort of the me myself?
And the short answer, maybe, to how do you reboot a classic, is that you can prescribe as many drugs as you like, but really, really, it's how your body reacts to them. It is really, as you say, it's the alchemy, it is the acting, it's delivering those words, and presumably it's the part that the audience plays in this as well. It should not be underestimated, I suppose.
Well, I think the audience plays a huge part in it, which often goes undervalued. I mean, I think a lot of audiences, and again, more so possibly in Newark, they can get a bit kind of clenched about, well, it shouldn't be like that. You know, when Bernadette Peters played Mama Rose in Gypsy, well, she shouldn't look like that. And I think the British audiences, like perhaps British theatre makers, are much more willing to just try it and see where kind of the aesthetic fallout takes place. I would venture a bet, even though Gillian Anderson and Ben Foster, both, of course, American actors with a huge presence in the States, I don't think that Streetcar that was done here at the Young Vic would or could have originated in America. I may be wrong, but I think there was something about the British willingness to kind of tilt the show or the play, the text, 180 degrees, and then just kind of shake it up. It's like those kind of, you know, globes that you shake up and all the snow falls, and you just want to see where the snow is going to fall.
Well, I love that a great American set text can be messed around with in an English production. The thing I love about the English language is American English, which is the right thing done wrongly with style. I love the fact that we can do it to you guys. Matt Wolfe, as ever, thank you very much for joining us.
A great pleasure. Thank you.
So what have we learned now? The reboot's on the other foot. That once something has attained classic status, has become a paid-up part of the canon, its steely interior is immune to the clothes it's made to wear, but sometimes it benefits from the warmth. If it ain't broke, play on how well it works might be the salient point. How do you reboot a classic? Carefully, cleverly, sometimes quietly, sometimes with a splash. You've been listening to Culture on Monocle 24. My producer was Holly Fisher, the original and best. Join us again at the same time next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound, and thank you very much for tuning in.